This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The following recording by the L.A. Sound Posse from June 21st of 2005 contains John's commentary on chapters 2 and 9 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, which is continued on a second disc, part 2, with the question and answer session. The L.A. Sound Posse records and publishes anti-copyrighted talks and events such as this and can be reached at lasoundposse.org. The contact information will be repeated at the end of the recording.
Okay, we're going to begin. Of course, everyone knows today's summer solstice, June 21st, the longest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. Today is also the 41st anniversary of the killing of the three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, June 21st, 1964. I was married that weekend, actually on June 20th, 1964. And in 1992, my ex-wife and I attended a memorial service at Cornell University when the class of 1962 at Cornell, where Mickey Schwerner had attended, the class of 62 dedicated a stained glass window in Sage Chapel on that campus in honor of the three slain activists. It's actually a very stunning stained glass window which has the Mississippi state flower, which I believe is the magnolia, and has the three of them. It evidently took the class of 1962 a little time to honor Mickey Schwerner and the other two young men who were killed. My ex and I reflect often, and certainly at this time of year, on the fact that the first, and I actually wrote about it years ago, I don't know what I did with it, the first sunrise that we saw together was the last sunrise that those three young men saw. As they died, it was a Sunday evening. Their lives, of course, and their loss are in the news just today, in fact. I mean, talk about a historical moment. A former member of the KKK was found guilty of the lesser charge of manslaughter. The jury was deadlocked on the charge of murder. He is the only person to face such charges in this case, even though a number of former KKK members and some, I would say, law enforcement officials from the state of Mississippi spent time in prison for violating the civil rights of the three young men. No murder charges, as far as I know, no murder charges were ever filed by the state of Mississippi in this case. And in this trial, a former mayor of Philadelphia, he testified, and Philadelphia, by the way, also made the news, Philadelphia, Mississippi, in 1980, because that was the site where Ronald Reagan began his campaign for president in 1980. Not an accident. It was a clear sign to white racists as to where Reagan stood with them in their resistance to democracy and racial harmony. He could have started his campaign anywhere. It's not an accident that it started in Philadelphia, Mississippi. So the mayor said when he was testifying that he knew some Klansmen at that time and over the years, and they were basically good folks, that the Klan did some good things and was a peaceful group. Okay, this is 2005, commenting on the past. This is what some whites in Mississippi believe about what we would call as American as apple pie terrorist groups, that all of us in this room know, conducted a campaign of lynching and other violence against blacks and some white allies for more than a century, beginning after the Civil War. Another sign also in the contemporary news that the issues raised by Zinn in these chapters are still with us was captured in the recent U.S. Senate resolution apologizing for decades of lynching that went on in the U.S., in the country, nearly all against blacks and almost all in the South, more than 4,700 by official count. Now, one might assume in the year 2005 that such a resolution, which is a mere apology that didn't demand anything from the Senate or the government, would have sailed through unanimously. That was not the case. 20 senators refused to sign on as co-sponsors, including Ted Cochran and Trent Lott of Mississippi, the state which led the nation in lynching in U.S. history. 20 did not. Only 80 senators co-sponsored the resolution. I don't know. I tried to check today on the internet to try to get a list, and I was unable. So irony piled on irony, or contradiction piled on contradiction. The resolution was drafted in the Richard Russell Senate office building, named after Richard Russell, the senator from Georgia, who used to use the filibuster to block the Senate from voting on anti-lynching legislation decades ago. It seems to me, it's just another example, the failure to obtain unanimous consent for this resolution is another reminder of the poison that continues to afflict the body politic of this country, a poison that I will argue in my comments that has been in the bloodstream of the U.S. since its founding. The U.S., by the way, the government has never officially apologized for slavery. And there is a group called the Committee for Formal Apology who's trying to get that through the Senate. We'll see how many decades that takes. Okay, some prefatory comments to these chapters, which are really about the color line, the most divisive issue in U.S. history. A long and deep history behind the racist color line, deeply embedded in the Constitution. And as we examine the Constitution, with or without help from Justice Scalia, it is easy to see that the founders' original intent was racist. It was not benign or an oversight. The 1790 naturalization law, for example, in the U.S., restricted citizenship to free white persons, quote unquote. When Washington became president in 1789, slavery was already the foundation of social and economic life in the South, and racism, of course, was well entrenched nationwide, and slavery extended beyond the southern United States. The 55 men who drafted the Constitution included many slave owners, and a fact that really blew my mind, I mean, I'd known some of it, 12 of the first 16 presidents of the U.S. were Southern slave owners. I mean, ponder that fact for a moment. 12 of the first 16 presidents. From 1776 on, slavery plagued a nation that asserted the equality of all men, and the men who wrote the Constitution sought to keep the recognition of slavery out of the basic form of the new government. And you will not find the word mentioned in the document. In a sense, if we jump ahead in U.S. history a bit in these chapters, one might argue that the whole legal base of slavery was enunciated in the extraordinary statement of Roger Taney, Chief Justice of the United States, in the famous 1857 Dred Scott decision that upheld the infamous Fugitive Slave Law, essentially arguing that blacks had always been regarded in America, quote, as having no rights that a white man was bound to respect. The African-American scholar and activist W.E.B. Du Bois concluded that despite the unending effort that went into painting the claims and charms of the Old South, it turned the most beautiful section of the nation into a center of poverty and suffering, an abode of ignorance. On the other hand, of course, one must recognize that slavery's economic profits helped to fuel the rise of industrial capitalism in Europe and England, especially, and enrich the ruling classes of that area and not just the U.S. South. The institution was supported by founders such as Jefferson, Madison, Washington, and Patrick Henry, all of whom owned slaves. And of course, we all remember from our school books the famous statement by Patrick Henry in his opposition to British colonialism, "Give me liberty or give me death." Of course, he would never think of extending this eloquent plea to his own slaves. There was always resistance to slavery from the beginning in this country, and white owners continually remained in a state of fear and worry. Their greatest fear was the potential of a cross-racial class solidarity between whites and blacks. In many ways, perhaps still their greatest fear, especially if people understand that they have much more in common than indifference. Without resistance and slave revolts, without the abolitionist movement, and most importantly, without the greatest conflict in U.S. history, the Civil War, without the efforts of blacks in the South as workers and soldiers, slave owners would have never, on their own, ended the master-slave relationship. No dominant class in history has ever done that, and it has not happened in U.S. history. Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, brilliantly articulated this truth, and I quote, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess freedom and yet deprecate agitation want rain without thunder and lightning. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will." When we jump to the present, jump up ahead of perhaps 100 years, we have to see in the most recent struggles against racism, especially coming out of the human rights movement in the South, that the changes that have undermined racism in our lifetimes have all come from the toil and efforts of the oppressed and some allies. Never, never, never as a gift from those who oppress them. Freedom is never given as a gift. Douglass's 4th of July oration in 1852 also articulated the fundamental truths about slavery and the country. He said, "Your 4th of July is a day that reveals that your liberty and equality are hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, sermons and thanksgivings, fraud, deception, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up the crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages." In the epic conflict over race and slavery, Abraham Lincoln tried to take the middle ground. But he did not believe, as Du Bois and others argued, in equality between the races. His desire was to save the Union and neither to save or destroy slavery. And our view of him, for those of us who were brought up in U.S. schools, has been shaped by incredible myths. In his epic work on U.S. history, Black Reconstruction in America, Du Bois points out that Lincoln was not an abolitionist. He did not believe in full black citizenship. He tried desperately to win the Civil War without black soldiers, and he emancipated the slaves only on account of military necessity, adding 200,000 black soldiers to the Union Army and thus ensuring its victory. While all of us here learned the myth that Lincoln freed the slaves and the Civil War was about slavery, we must also recognize that as the war unfolded, the idea that it was to abolish slavery was even met with constant and indignant denial in the North. In the early years of the Civil War, Union generals permitted slave masters to come and remove slaves from within the Union lines. What Frederick Douglass said about the war was essentially true. It was begun in the interest of slavery on both sides. The South was fighting to take slavery out of the Union, and the North to keep it in the Union. The South fighting to get it beyond the limits of the US Constitution, and the North for the old guarantees, but both sides essentially despising and insulting the Negro. End of quote. Du Bois's essential argument in Black Reconstruction is that the North started out to fight the war without touching slavery. It was not abolitionist and was overwhelmingly in favor of Negro slavery. But there was a minority who hated slavery and who wanted no union with slave owners, who fought for freedom and treated Negroes as men. They and their Black friends and the new freed people became gradually the leaders of a reconstruction of democracy, that very short period in US history when there was at least a minimal support by the national government in favor of democracy and freedom. After the Civil War, of course, Douglass and others called for an economic base to assist the newly freed people, but this did not happen, and the old efforts at exploitation came around and continued as before. Terror against blacks and white supporters began immediately after the war ended, as the South ignored the Reconstruction Amendments and civil rights laws, aided by the federal government in Washington. This ushered in a period of brutal white supremacy in the South, essentially between 1890 all the way through the 1960s. The official ideology in the United States was racist, and its ideal of racial purity most dramatically expressed in laws forbidding interracial marriage. Laws that continued until they were declared unconstitutional in 1967 in a case Loving versus Virginia. So through the 1960s, it was still illegal in, I believe, 16 states in the Union. And those prohibitions, by the way, when polling was done up through the 60s, were supported overwhelmingly by whites in the country. What did exactly white supremacy or apartheid in the South during this era, say from the late 19th century through the 1960s, mean to black people as a race? It meant the following. They could not attend white schools. They could not drink from the same water fountains. They could not relieve themselves in the same toilets. They could not wash their hands in the same basins. They could not eat in the same restaurants. They could not sleep in the same motels and hotels. They could not sit next to whites in public halls, concerts, on buses or streetcars, or any other means of public transportation. They could not be born in the same hospital or buried in the same graveyards. There were conflicts in the southern United States in the 1960s when the attempt was made to bury Vietnam veterans who were African American who had been killed in Vietnam. They could not be buried in cemeteries with white veterans. This is during the Vietnam War. They could not expect to live in the same neighborhoods. They could not hold the same jobs or attain the same standard of living. It was a system of apartheid. Except for a few, very few, principled whites who were allies. During this entire period, there was no real outcry, protest, or outrage, especially in the South, but elsewhere in the country. But here we're talking about the South, from clergy, educators, business leaders, or politicians. It is crucial to understand that fact in history and to know that at every single stage in US history from 1776, the struggle to extend democracy to blacks and other oppressed racial groups was vigorously opposed by broad sectors of the nation's most powerful elites and by the population as a whole. Well, we tend to romanticize the past, that all these people in the country were supporting the civil rights movement in the 60s. Well, if you go back and read the history of the civil rights movement in the 60s, and even at some of the peak moments, such as the March on Washington, August 28, 1963, 2 months later, Time magazine did a special on the Negro Revolution, and that even at that time, 1963, the majority of whites polled believed that blacks were moving too fast in the country. This is before the explosions in the northern cities of our country. So historically, therefore, for most of its existence, most of the existence of this society as a European colony and as an independent nation, it has been argued, not only by Du Bois, but a number of other scholars, that the U.S. essentially has been a racial dictatorship. The brief, somewhat egalitarian experiment known as Reconstruction after the Civil War, 10, 15 years perhaps, was followed by almost a century of legally sanctioned apartheid that only fell legally, de jure segregation, in the mid-1960s. This apartheid history, mandated by law and upheld by terror, not just by law, behind the velvet glove of law was the terror of the KKK and other groups. This continued after World War I into the 1960s. Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson acted against it only after public protest, not before. They were never ahead of the civil rights struggle. Progressive changes were brought about by courageous blacks, especially returning veterans from World War II and Korea and Vietnam, by the implication and horror of the Holocaust in World War II, by the rising anti-colonial movements in the Third World, and, as evidenced by a growing and fine literature, by the impact of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. The period after World War II was particularly critical. In a very fine book called Cold War and Civil Rights, a professor at USC, Mary Dudziak, asserts that during that period, that is the Cold War period, the diplomatic impact of race in America led to civil rights reforms that were in part a product of the Cold War. Racial injustice here led to problems in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and race relations in the United States were profoundly shaped by external foreign relations, especially the conflict with the Soviet Union. The major concern for political leaders in the U.S. was how, quote, domestic events would influence the Cold War of balance. They never were committed to racial justice. That is, they never did the right thing for the right reason. They were always looking over their shoulder. They were always worried when, for example, ambassadors and other officials from Africa would not be allowed to stop on the roads, for example, between New York and Washington, D.C., and be served in restaurants in places like Maryland. Okay. These were terrible incidents. They made the U.S. look bad. Du Bois, of course, understood this international historical link. He argued that we could not understand the black experience in the U.S. without reference to the global context. He tied his critique of racism to capitalist exploitation of white labor in the North and black labor in the South, and exploitation, he said, was supported by a staggering level of violence and imperialism against people of color here and throughout the world. And we have voluminous historical literature documenting the argument that Du Bois made, from King Leopold in the Belgian Congo to South Africa to Indonesia, when you go through the British and the French and the Dutch, etc. So without the historical pressure of events and movements against racism, the Supreme Court in 1954 would never have unanimously decided that segregation in education was unconstitutional in Brown versus Board of Education. John Fitzgerald Kennedy does not make eloquent speeches on civil rights in 1963. Lyndon Baines Johnson does not get up before Congress and millions of Americans and say, "We shall overcome," without the movement, the struggle, the deaths of people, the imprisonment of thousands of others, the harassment by the FBI. So when you think about changes in the country, when you think about segregation being declared unconstitutional in 1954, you have to ask yourself, why wasn't it declared unconstitutional in 1904 or 1854, since blacks have been in the forefront since the rise of mass education in the United States in the struggles for equality in schooling? What changed? Not the Constitution and abstract laws. What changed was the social and historical climate in the United States, and what changed that were the struggles of ordinary Americans. That historical climate was challenged by the great human rights struggle of the 1950s and 60s, though of course it began before that, that transformed in many ways the political and cultural landscape of the United States. The work of these what have been called at times racial minority movements achieved limited but very powerful reforms for racial justice and equality in this country. The anti-racist movements of the 1960s redefined the meaning of racial identity and of race itself in this country. Manning Mirabel, among others, has argued that the very idea of sharply different races, our very conception of race, is a social creation, and that that conception has buttressed both white supremacy and class rule in the United States. And he argues that we have to understand not only why some people come to be black, Asian, Native American, but also, quote unquote, the invention of the white race. European immigrants, for example, did not just become Americans, they became white Americans. And there are two marvelous books on this subject. One is called How the Irish Became White, and the other is called Are Italians White? They both address this issue, the definition of immigrants coming to this country and how they define themselves. Many Irish immigrants, for example, in coming to the United States and facing oppression, sadly rejected the pleas of their great nationalist and anti-racist leader Daniel O'Connell in the 1840s to side with blacks and abolitionists against slavery. He reminded them that, quote, "It was not in Ireland that you learned this cruelty." Racism is not merely an attitude, it is deeply entrenched in practices, institutions, and structures. The attitudes have dramatically changed in this country. The structures and institutions remain very much in place. Racism directly sustains or proposes to establish a racial order, a hierarchical order, a permanent group hierarchy that is believed to reflect the laws of nature or the decrees of God. The divine arguments used to be stronger in the 17th, 18th, 19th century. The laws of nature, perhaps the laws of genetics, became stronger with the rise of eugenics in the early 20th century. Though given the rise of Christian fundamentalism, who knows, we may be going full circle in terms of the arguments to justify racism. Racism has two components: difference, but most importantly, power. To achieve its full development, let me back up for a minute because there's a little addition here I want to put in, that so that we don't merely see racism as simply an historical attribute of the United States merely being white against black. Michael Parenti, for example, in a book Against Empire, argues that the earliest victims of the Western European notions of racism were actually other Europeans who were also Caucasian. For example, some 800 years ago, Ireland became the first colony of what later became known as the British Empire. And if you read the history of British colonialism in Ireland, you will see how the Irish were actually defined as a race and comments made about them very akin to the comments made about blacks and other racial minorities in the US. And of course, the British absolutely savaged Ireland, burned villages, and as we talked about in our discussion of Columbus a couple of months ago, the British practiced in Ireland on the Irish what the British then later would do to indigenous peoples here in North America. Other early Caucasian victims of Western Europeans included Eastern Europeans, the people that Charlemagne worked to death in his mines in the early 9th century were Slavs. So frequent and prolonged, Parenti argues, was the enslavement of Eastern Europeans that Slav became synonymous with servitude, and indeed the word slave derives from the word Slav. So it's not just simply a black-white issue, but certainly in the West, racism as a political project has been from the oppressor, white Europeans, to those of color from Africa and on this continent. It's a political project. It creates or reproduces structures of domination based on essential categories of race. Some scholars argue that this project or modern conception of race did not occur until the rise of Europe and the arrival of Europeans in the Americas. Therefore, the conquest begun by Columbus, it has been argued, was perhaps the first and greatest racial formation project in human history, and that this project was also linked, as we discussed 2 or 3 months ago, to the rising anti-Semitism and attacks on Jews in Europe at the same time. For those of you who are here in our discussion of Columbus, you recall that essentially the same month, almost to the same day, that the three ships left, Columbus's ships left Spain, ships left the same harbor with Jews having been expelled from Spain by Queen Isabella. They almost literally crossed each other in the harbor. The enduring foundation of racism or white supremacy is the belief that Euro-Americans of white ancestry, especially Northern and Western Europeans, are collectively superior in intelligence and creativity to other people. Therefore, the dominant ideas on race are created and sustained by rulers who must maintain a system of ideas and practices that then become our common sense. And that common sense then is passed on in schools, in the media, in religious institutions. White supremacy or racism is perhaps the most fundamental common sense in US history, something that has been woven through the major institutions and social relations in law, in political organizations, in the economy, in religion, in cultural life, in residential patterns, in education, etc. Going back to Manning Marable, Marable argues, in terms of the racial dynamics, that without a racialized other, whites would cease to exist. The whole conception of what it is to be white would cease to exist. He reminds us that the memorable phrase, "all men are created equal," written by Thomas Jefferson, had absolutely nothing to do with black people, whether they were enslaved or legally free, or indigenous Americans / American Indians. The founding fathers understood, when you read them, you study that history, brilliant political insights, by the way. Whatever we may think of their political, economic, philosophic, cultural views, no group of rulers in this society gave as much thought to running a country as those group of men did 200 plus years ago. People today, the best you can name in the 20th century group of individuals, don't even come close to Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton. When we read their arguments, they understood, though, that the language of equality did not apply to black people, to people from Africa in the Caribbean, who by common consent had been excluded from civilized government and the family of nations and doomed, almost all of them, to slavery. So it's this legacy that this generation confronts, a horrific one that enslaved, killed, and demeaned tens of millions of people and has poisoned the moral and political fabric of the country. Du Bois argued more than a century ago, of course, that the color line would be the most fundamental problem of the 20th century, and we're now in the 21st, and I would argue that he is right when we look at what is happening in the world. So we need, here we are in a group talking about U.S. history, we need to have an accurate memory. We need to resurrect a critical historical understanding of what actually has happened through the whole period, the colonies, the colonization of the United States, the invasion we talked about, and then the formal political history since 1776, and then with the establishment of the Constitution and the first president in 1789. That is, we need to have a memory, an accurate memory that emerges from a critical historical understanding of where we have been, what actually happened, and why. If we do not have that, we do not know where we are now, and we have no guidelines for the future. Okay, thank you. Let's take a short break and then come back and open it up. Let's take 5 or 10 and stretch and...
You have been listening to Dr. John Marciano's commentary on chapters 2 and 9 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. The discussion group met on June 21st of 2005. The question and answer session is available in part 2 on a second disc. Every month, a group led by Dr. Marciano meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or johnmarciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of the decentralized democratic civic media.